music by local student and professional musicians playing genres from classical to Irish to jazz to rock. Again, that's the third annual Northwest Quartet Fest on Saturday, December 7th from noon to 8 p.m. at Kennedy Violins, 508 Southeast 117th Avenue in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good.
It's good.
Excellent.
Yeah, good.
Good evening and welcome to Prison Pipeline. My name is Emma Lugo. I use she and her pronouns, and I'm here tonight with Morgan Godwin.
Hi.
Welcome. So tonight we are going to be talking about a whole bunch of issues, mostly about doing time in federal prison and also issues related to the incarceration of people who are LGBTQ and harassment that happens to folks because of their sexual orientation. So welcome, Morgan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. So Morgan, I think we kind of crossed paths. I don't know if we really chatted, but the Women in Prison Conference just happened. It was like about a week and a half ago. It was amazing. Over at the Portland Art Museum, organized by the Oregon Justice Resource Center.
I love them.
How was the conference for you?
That's my second time attending the conference. I love it every time, especially when they bring the women in prison to speak. Mm-hmm. To say it's triggering, though, would be an understatement.
My
experience is still so fresh, but that's exactly why I love it.
Yeah, it was really well attended. I think there were over 200 people in attendance. Amazing panel. It was all about survivor victims, which, you know, it's so sad because this morning in Vancouver, there's a whole community of people mourning the loss of a mother who was just gunned down in front of her children at a public school in Vancouver by her ex-husband, who she had issued a restraining order against. And she was murdered in front of her children. And, you know, the prison, the conference this year was all about how domestic violence, like, affects women. And yeah. What role it plays in incarceration.
Yeah, that's something I saw firsthand when I sat at Multnomah County Jail and just met hundreds, if not thousands, of women. Women that the government were calling criminals because they were in jail. But mm-hmm. when you talk to them, it was very obvious that they were victims.
Yeah. So let's start tonight. First of all, tell us your story, Morgan. You've got a really great story to share.
Yeah, so I grew up here in outer southeast Portland. I went to Centennial High School. And a couple of years after graduation, me and many of my friends started using OxyContin. I'd been prescribed some opiates in the past, but you know, we started using OxyContin recreationally. And when that got incredibly expensive, we switched over to heroin. And you know, in short time, I became addicted to heroin.
It's really cheap.
at the time, I remember two 80 milligram OxyContins were $160. And that was about equivalent to $20 worth of heroin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it made financial sense at the time. Mm-hmm. And heroin it used to be so scary. When I was a kid, nobody did heroin.
Right, right.
Yeah. heroin was like a four-letter word. Like, oh my gosh, heroin.
So I'm like a generation, I must be a generation older than you because like, I remember how it like, yeah, because, right. Okay, anyways.
Yeah. but it just seemed like it just came out of nowhere, because overnight the like degrees of separation really reduced. It wasn't like I know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody. Like, it was like, oh yeah, my friend does heroin.
Yeah.
That guy's cousin does heroin. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when you get more exposure to it and it becomes closer sort of to your universe, it becomes less scary.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first time somebody, you know, I was actually at my friend Justin's apartment, and you just smoke it, you know, on tinfoil. It didn't seem that threatening. Mm-hmm. Little did I know what was to come later in the story. But at the time, you know,
I mean, what's threatening is the criminal justice system. That's what's threatening.
I mean, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So one of the first times I ever did heroin, this was long before I was addicted. Mind you, you can recreational use heroin. And I know that's not, a common belief, but I was not physically dependent on it, at least. And it was maybe the fourth or fifth time I'd done it. And I had anti-anxiety medication in my bloodstream that I had taken when I was at work that day, never thinking intentionally I'm mixing drugs to mix drugs. But, you know, I bought the $20 worth of heroin, and me and my boyfriend went back to our apartment in Gladstone, and we're smoking it, and that's the last thing I remember. And then I opened my eyes, and I'm surrounded by cops and paramedics. Mm-hmm. And my boyfriend had called 911 to save my life.
Mm-hmm.
He did save my life. The paramedics administered Narcan. And then they arrested him and charged him with felony possession of heroin. Because an arrest was made out of our apartment, we were immediately evicted. He was convicted of a felony and terminated from his job as a security guard. So overnight, we went from being fairly stable 18, 19-year-olds to homeless and jobless.
Mm-hmm.
Not because of the drugs themselves, but because of drug policy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, a few years after that, the law changed, and we made that Good Samaritan protection so that if someone calls 911 during an overdose, they cannot be charged with a felony like he was.
Mm-hmm.
But that law didn't change in time for us.
Mm-hmm.
And that really sort of changed the course of my life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then time went on. You enrolled in the Air Force, and then you got out of the Air Force, and you were you selling? Was that what you were doing? Were you
dealing? Not by any like common definition of the term.
Yeah.
Especially, so I delivered pizza, mm-hmm. right? So that's what I always did. I'm a pizza delivery driver. Heck, I'm still a pizza delivery driver, actually. Okay. Mm-hmm. Occasionally. And so, you know, while I was doing that, I would just, whatever I made in tips that day was how much heroin I was buying. But then when I was 24, my mom died suddenly. My mom, the retired Air Force Master mm-hmm. Sergeant, who didn't use drugs,
mm-hmm.
died of an accidental overdose of her prescription pills.
Mm-hmm.
And she was prescribed, you know, by a doctor and used as prescribed, but she had COPD, and so she had a compromised respiratory function, and she overdosed and died. It's not actually that surprising when you look at the medication she was on.
My condolences.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And that changed my life, because I got a bunch of money from the life insurance, and I had been living with my mom, so then I had to find somewhere else to live. And of course, I found, you know, another person who uses drugs, because it's weird to live with people who don't use drugs when you use drugs, because mm-hmm. that's just weird.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just kind of group up. It's natural. So I moved in there, and I had a bunch of money, and I never considered myself a drug dealer. But for the first time in my life, I could just like afford to buy more than 8 hours worth of heroin at a time.
Mm-hmm.
I was buying like 2 days worth of heroin at a time. I know, crazy. Mm-hmm. Pretty much a kingpin.
That goes pretty fast.
Yeah. I mean, it really does, especially when I had all that money. So my tolerance skyrocketed. My roommate was a really like low level dealer, but I was able to just buy, you know, walk upstairs, knock on the bedroom door, buy heroin, sit on my couch. And one night my friend Justin texted me. We'd been doing heroin together now for, 5 years?
Mm-hmm.
Buying back and forth. Mostly me buying from him, because I was always broke. But since my mom just died, I had this money. He texted me. He needed a gram. And it didn't feel like a crime. It was something I'd done hundreds of times. Oh, yeah. You know, when you're physically dependent on heroin, you get sick without it.
Right.
Very sick. So you never want your friends to experience that.
Yeah. A really good book about that is Junkie by William Burroughs. It really describes that whole process really well.
You know, I haven't actually read it.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the list.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so when he texted me, I had like just enough in my personal bag to spare a gram without like running out that night. And so I sold it to him. And I didn't think anything about it. I didn't think twice about it. And then the next night I'm sitting on my couch, same couch, haven't showered or moved because I'm so strung out. I'm so depressed. And my front door comes flying open. And it's the police. You know, Washington County, we have a warrant. And they put their guns in my face. Hands up, hands up, hands up. And I remember thinking really clearly, like, oh, my roommate's in trouble. You know, because he was, you know, a small fry dealer. And I never thought it was for me. I never thought the police could be there for me until they put me in handcuffs and said, do you know what the Len Bias Act is, which is delivery resulting in death?
Right.
And do you know Justin? And they said that as they were, you know, putting me in handcuffs and arresting me. And that's how I was informed one of my best friends in the whole world was dead.
So you lost overdose. One of your best friends and you're incarcerated at the same time.
They didn't actually take me into custody until 3 months later. But essentially, so my mom dies, I get raided 3 months later, I'm taken into custody. Yeah, and then told I'm facing a 20-year mandatory minimum sentence for the federal crime of delivery resulting in death.
Wow.
It was a lot for a 24-year-old to handle. Yeah.
Did you ever think about just fleeing the country?
I did,
yeah,
because I was sort of on the run for a while, but I was so addicted to heroin. There was no, like, I couldn't like stray that far away.
Yeah.
I was so desperate. I thought about suicide. That seemed much more accessible. And I was so depressed. I mean, you know, I just lost my mom and then my friend, and I'm facing, I know I'm in big trouble and the police are after me. So suicide sounded like a viable option at the time. Thank God I didn't actually do it.
Right.
Yeah, and then I got arrested and booked into Multnomah County Inverness Jail.
So you did, with your bio that you sent me, you told me you did about 2 years altogether in, like, county jail, and then you did another 3 years in federal jail.
Two years.
You did 2 years in federal prison.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And you were mentioning that, like, in the county jails, there were some conditions that were really kind of shocking to you.
Yeah. So, I mean, when I was at Multnomah County Jail, they didn't give you tampons. Okay, they would just give you pads. And tampons weren't even for sale. It was this weird dynamic they had there. And I just, I'll never forget this incident. I bled through my pants because they're making us sleep in pads. And so I need new pants, but you only get laundry exchange twice a week. So I asked the guard, male guard, Officer Bell, I remember your name, to get me new pants. And he told me no, and that I should have been more careful.
Oh, my God.
And I never considered myself a feminist before that moment. But in that moment, I was like, oh, no. This is where I draw the line.
Yeah.
And then just, like, general jail conditions. So, you know, when you come in and you're detoxing off a substance, they don't give you medication. They say they do, but what they're actually giving you is like a blood pressure medication and an antihistamine. Like, that's not. And they have buprenorphine. They have the cure.
Yeah.
And they refuse to give it to us. Why? Well, because we're drug addicts and we should suffer.
I mean, you're just like going through the DTs like crazy.
Yeah.
And
it's horrible and unnecessary.
Yeah.
I saw people get kicked off of their methadone and then their Suboxone that they'd been prescribed by a doctor and stabilized, but then they need to come into jail for any reason and the jail just refuses to give it to you. That's what they did to me when I was violated out of drug court in 2013. I was on Suboxone and they just refused to give it to you. A life-saving medication that increases survival rates of opiate use disorder, and they pull you off of it and then release you to the street.
Wow.
And then they're surprised when people overdose and die. One of the worst things in jail is just how you're treated. To be degraded and dehumanized all the time. You know, the lights never turn off. When I was at Multnomah County Jail, a 15-minute phone call was $6.
That's just such exploitation.
It's horrible. You know, and I don't have kids. So I was sitting, I was making all these phone calls, talking to my friends about like what they ate for lunch that day. Mm-hmm. And the woman next to me couldn't call her kid on the first day of school. And there was nothing I could do about it. I couldn't give them a phone call. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, jail, illegal, prohibited. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. There's so many rules.
Yeah. And then the mostly male guards communicate essentially entirely by just screaming. Mm-hmm. That's just their default. Mm-hmm. Mode of communication. Sit down. Mm-hmm. Shut up. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, anecdotally, as I'm just talking to women, it would appear well over 90% of them report histories of sexual trauma.
Yeah.
Violence committed against them by men.
Yeah. That was one of, I mean, at the Women in Prison conference, that was like the main theme. Yeah. of the conference this year was just talking about how trauma affects women. And like almost everyone who's incarcerated at Coffee Creek has some history of abuse by a man. That's like part of the story of how they ended up there. And, you know, it's even more challenging for people who are queer. Yeah. You know, and I know that you were talking about some of your experiences in federal prison. And hopefully we can also talk about someone that we know at Coffee Creek before the show's over, who's also experiencing something similar.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm queer. The federal prison I was at, it wasn't as strict, but there's this law called PREA, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, that Congress implemented to prevent rape in men's prisons. Okay, first off, it took an act of Congress to force prisons to try to stop rape mm-hmm. from occurring in their prisons. Mm-hmm. Literally, it took an act of Congress to do that. It does not apply the same way in a women's prison.
Right.
At all.
Yeah, I think that one of the points that was made at the conference that was so moving was that, you know, women's prisons are like basically modeled on men's prisons. Right. And maybe it's time to rethink that. I mean, because women have different needs, different expectations, and I mean, doing time like in a women's prison shouldn't be the same experience as doing time in a men's prison. I mean, there's fundamental differences.
Yeah, I mean.
But I mean, really, like from my perspective, I'm an abolitionist, so I don't want any prisons. Right. I want it to be like the woman who opened the conference on the second day who said, you know, I'm a Native woman. And for 10,000 years in my land, which you're occupying, there were no prisons. Yeah. Literally, for 10,000 mm-hmm. years, there were no prisons until white people came here and started building them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm an abolitionist. But anyways, let's talk about... yeah, yeah. So, but let's talk about that because, you know, that's... people who are in prison, like, they need touch, they need affection. I mean, it not only helps to do time to have, like, you know, some sort of connection mm-hmm. with another person and with the people around you in your community. But like, I mean, I know when I talk to women, like that's like something that women just, it's a very normal part of like female bonding and communication and mm-hmm. building allyship and like, you know, building community is touch. It's an essential part of that.
It's a basic human need.
Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, what is it? I mean, can people do that in prison?
Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Physical contact is strictly prohibited. I mean, a high five, a hand on a knee, mm-hmm. a hug. Mm-hmm. You can go to the hole. You can go into segregation and lose good time for this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This actually happened to my friend who mm-hmm. was listening. Mm-hmm. Hi, Mariah. Love you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so basic.
Yeah.
Like someone's crying. Okay, someone just found out that a loved one of theirs died. Your normal human reaction is to comfort them with physical touch.
Mm-hmm.
The rules and regulations of prison challenge our normal responses. Like that's just instinct for me to reach out and comfort you. And my instinct could get me sent to the hole.
Mm-hmm.
And that is cruel. Prohibiting human contact is cruel.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a men's prison. There is not sexual assault. So these rules that they put as if, you know, it was just rapists trolling around, you know, sexual predators, it's mm-hmm. preposterous. Mm-hmm. And what it boils down to, it's lesbian hunting. Okay. And so in my, I can speak from my experience in federal prison, there were certain guards known to be lesbian hunters, and they would walk around with their flashlights and hold their keys so they don't jingle, so you don't hear them coming, and then just sneak up and peek in the rooms and try to catch you having sex. And that just brought them joy in life. And then when they catch you, that they can actually charge you with a crime under PREA. But if they don't, you're charged with a high level offense under prison misconduct. You go to segregation, so you're in a cell by yourself for 45 days, and then you lose your good conduct time. So you're actually doing extra time in prison because you touched another human being.
Mm-hmm. And often, most of the time, I assume it's consensual.
I never heard of a non-consensual sexual experience in the prison I was at.
What's
non-consensual
it,
touch.
What's it like for people doing, I mean, 45 days in segregation, just that must be hell.
I am so fortunate that that never happened to me. That happened to my friend who is at Coffee Creek. It's awful, and in some of the strangest ways. So it's bright, you know. So you're by yourself, or you might have a cellmate, depending on their levels of overcrowding. But there's no recreation. There's nothing to pass the time. The lights never turn off, and you're just watched, you know, at like a very close distance by guards constantly. So they're just constantly peeking on you, checking on you, making you stand up so they can count you like cattle. And that is your punishment for fulfilling one of your basic human needs.
So you did 2 years in federal prison in California, and then you got out?
I did. I was released.
How was that?
Yeah, I mean, getting out of prison is always, it's like, you know, when you're a kid, the night before Christmas or like Christmas Day, it's so exciting. I don't think anything will ever match that level of excitement. I did my time in California because there's no women's prison here in Oregon. So, you know, I was getting released from prison and coming home. So there's this incredible sensation of, oh my God, it's so good to be home in the land of evergreen trees and the smell. And I was released last January 2018, and I immediately enrolled at Portland State University and have been a full-time student there ever since.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And you just had an article in the Washington Post?
I did.
Yeah. What was that about?
That was about my friend Justin. And so that was me being sentenced to 5 years in federal prison for selling my friend Justin the gram of heroin, off of which he overdosed and died. The point of the article is that the 5 years I got was very low, and then there's people across the country being sentenced to decades and life in prison for sharing drugs or selling drugs to their friend or brother or boyfriend. And that breaks my heart, because that is not justice.
Yeah, people are still in Oregon, where we think, oh, we're making all of this progress, like now we have legalized cannabis, and I mean, I think people feel like it must be going in the opposite direction, but it's not at all. It's getting worse.
Last legislative session, they proposed a bill to do this delivery resulting in death law in Oregon, so that you would go to, you know, Coffee Creek or Oregon State Prison for selling drugs to someone that died, with long mandatory minimum sentences, even though all evidence ever says mandatory minimum sentences, you know, are ineffective, are a bad deal. And that incarceration is never effective to treat substance use disorder. And it just makes people more likely to overdose and die. Like the government here in Portland, okay, so my case, so I had four co-defendants. The government will spend $1.2 million incarcerating us. Where were those resources when Justin was alive?
Right.
Right.
Why are we spending those resources on mitigation, on, you know, anything that like can help people like overcome addiction if that's a problem? And why don't we spend it on resources that are really needed, like helping to house homeless people?
Exactly.
And, you know, putting more money into our schools and on reparations for people of color, for slavery, or anything besides just putting millions of dollars into the prisons, which are a failure.
and utter failure.
Yeah.
Institutional racism and everything.
Yeah. So, wow. Well, I mean, thank you so much for sharing your story, Morgan. What are some of the things that, like, coming out of your experiences you've had so far in life, like, I mean, what did you learn from that? What's changed for you?
I literally used to think racism didn't exist. Mm-hmm. So that was a really powerful lesson. You know, I grew up in Portland and I'm like second generation queer in Portland. I thought, oh, this is a bastion of tolerance and diversity in Portland, Oregon. And I realized how privileged and naive that was of me to ever think that. But I had to go through this experience to arrive at that conclusion. You know, my mom was career military. I joined the Air Force. I was fairly patriotic, and I really believed that my country was so fair and just. Mm-hmm. And then my country broke my heart. Mm-hmm. They showed me a very different side mm-hmm. of them. And so now it's my life's work to bring justice back to our criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. And substance use is not, should never be criminalized. You should never go to jail because you're choosing to use a substance. This is America. Isn't this the land of personal freedoms?
I use substances all the time. I just took a couple of Advil.
See, right? Mm-hmm. Exactly.
For pain.
You know, and alcohol kills mm-hmm. way more people than all the other drugs combined. Mm-hmm. But that's okay.
Right. Yeah.
So now, yeah, I'm using my experiences. I just keep sharing my story, both my experience. So prison conditions need to change mm-hmm. immediately.
Right.
Cruel and unusual punishment is occurring every day in mm-hmm. all jails and prisons across the country. Mm-hmm. And the public needs to wake up and see that and stop. Those inmates, those prisoners. No, that's us. These are our community members. These are my friends. These are my family members. And, you know, completely need to revamp our laws. Mm-hmm.
And so you're, and it sounds like this is part of your life's work now. You're at OHSU and you're planning on going into law school?
Yeah, so I'm at the PSU-OHSU School of Public Health, getting a degree in public health, but to go to law school, perhaps mm-hmm. work in public health law, perhaps not, but, you know, criminal justice reform.
That's
is
great.
Imminent.
So if you follow through with your law degree, what would you be doing? What do you hope to be doing?
Excellent question.
Say 10 years.
I hope to be working, you know, criminal defense is where my heart lies, but I want to find a way to sort of find the intersection between criminal defense and policy. I want to affect policy. I don't want to just help one person at a time. This system needs to change, the entire system across the entire country. Mm-hmm. And then also because of the federal prison I was at, I got a very up close and personal view of our immigration system and our deportation system and mm-hmm. The cruelties within that. So I also have a special interest in immigration law. So I don't exactly know what I will be doing other than trying to bring justice and to end this massive human rights crisis that we have occurring domestically that everybody sort of turns a blind eye to in this country. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Morgan. It sounds like maybe we can have you back another time to talk about some more issues. Talking about immigration and federal prisons would be really interesting. So, Morgan, if people want to find out more about you, is there a website or someplace they can go to learn more about your story?
Yeah, morgangodvin.com.
Morgan Godvin.
Yeah.
Godvin.
That's right.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much for joining us tonight on Prison Pipeline. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, everyone. Have a good night.
You are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. The time is 6:58. Up next, Hard Knock Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Escape Reality Reanimated, running on Friday and Saturday, December 6th, 7th, and December 13th, 14th at Milepost 5 in Portland. Escape Reality, performed by a 5-member sketch troupe, features completely new sketches, extraterrestrials and felines included, with a few returning characters. Again, that's Escape Reality Reanimated, running on Friday and Saturday, December 6th and 7th, and December 13th and 14th at 7 p.m. at Milepost 5. 8155 Northeast Oregon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month we'll show the documentary film The Cave on Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. The Cave is a story of female doctors saving lives in a secret underground hospital in Syria. The film follows the women as they contend with daily bombardments, chronic supply shortages, and the ever-present threat of chemical attacks. It paints a stirring portrait of courage, resilience, and female solidarity. Again, that's The Cave on Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And I want you to listen to what I listen to, Hard Knock Radio.
Yo, this ain't your boy, this your brother, Ice Life.
Mm-hmm.
And this M1 International, RBG all day, baby. On Hard Knock Radio, word up, 4 to 5. Check it out, sir.
Can I be the one to bring you joy?
What's up, y'all? This is Lettucey with Hard Knock Radio.
What up, everybody? If you're just tuning in, it's Hard Knock Radio. Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. On today's show, we're going to let you hear